Breeze Kenosha, 42 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information on all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are changing our plans from what was initially announced for today's morning show because we want to talk about a very important event that actually happens tonight. It is co-sponsored by the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism and Carthage College. They are co-sponsoring a so-called courageous conversation called Moving Beyond Denial, Racism in Faith Communities. And in this conversation, people of all kinds of different religious faith are invited to come together and think about the possibility that there may actually be racist attitudes, maybe in the way different faith communities are structured, even in the canon of what they believe, or in the way that they have treated one another or certain members, or looked at the outside world. Chances are all of us have racist attitudes and biases within us that we are not consciously aware. And it can be a difficult process to come to grips with that and to be honest about that possibility. That's at least one facet of what this so-called courageous conversation is about. And this is something that the public is warmly invited to participate in, and we will be talking about how that is possible in just a little bit. Joining me today on the morning show to talk about tonight's courageous conversation about racism is, first of all, Rabbi Dina Feingold, who is chair of the organizing committee for tonight's event, and she is also a member of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. And also joining us is Reverend Cara Baylor, who is the campus pastor at Carthage College. And Carthage, of course, as we've already said, is co-sponsoring this event. We welcome both of you to the morning show. We're so glad that you're here.
Thank you.
Rabbi Feingold, let's begin with you with just a quick summary of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. Tell us a little bit about this organization, when it was organized, and if anything in particular prompted the creation of this coalition.
I think it's been around for 20 or more years. And I wasn't a full-fledged member of it until fairly recently, about 2 years ago. But my understanding is that it began with a terrible hate crime that happened in Kenosha back at that time when a couple of young men were intentionally targeted when they were on their bikes by someone in a car. And it provoked a large conversation in the community around racism. And conversations rotated around to different congregations. Beth Hillel hosted one at the time. And also, this was the organization, people may know it best, for Kindness Week. The coalition created Kindness Week. And as a member of the interfaith clergy community here, I've always been involved with Kindness Week. Traditionally, we've had a interfaith service during the week that focused on whatever the theme of Kindness Week was that year. But I think probably in other than Kindness Week in recent years, people know it best for these courageous conversations that the coalition has been sponsoring for several years now. And after attending a few of them a few years ago, I decided to become an active member in the coalition, and I've been on it for, I believe, a little over 2 years now.
So tell us what the nature of some of these past courageous conversations have been. And have they been relatively similar to what is going to be occurring tonight?
Well, we never had one on religion, but a topic will be chosen, like education, for example. And I particularly remember one at the Civil War Museum that was really profound and exposed a lot of the disparities that exist in public education. And there were educators from our area who spoke and were very, presented a lot of material that was very challenging. And then there was a conversation, as it's, described, that ensues among those in attendance who were educators, community people, community leaders. And those kinds of conversations tend to, I think, prompt people to think in new directions, and that, of course, is the point of it. But they've been on all kinds of different topics. This year, after the Kenosha crisis, I call it, the events here at the end of August that were so dramatic, there was just one night when there was a conversation from people in the community about what that experience was like for them and how it's affected them personally in their lives. And of course, now we've moved online because of the pandemic. So that was an online conversation between a number of people on Zoom, and then people who were listening could send in questions. And that's the format that our conversation this evening will take as well.
Very good. We want to bring in Pastor Cara Baylor, campus pastor at Carthage, who at Carthage, of course, is also co-sponsoring tonight's event. Pastor Baylor, tell us about some of what has happened at Carthage around issues of racism and inclusion, and the role that you have played in some of those, especially recent efforts around some of these concerns.
Yeah, so we have the privilege at Carthage of having a small department within the Division of Student Affairs that focuses on diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's led by Roger Moriano, and then the assistant director, Cicely Hunter, who is a Kenosha native and daughter. So, I have the opportunity to partner with the DEI office a lot on some of the programs that happen around race and racism on campus. I like Rabbi Feingold's Kenosha crisis, language around what happened this summer. And I have partnered with Roger and Slee on different programs that they had, being a speaker at them or providing, prayers and benediction and all of that. But also, what we like to do at Carthage through the Center for Faith and Spirituality is to provide what we call, provocative encounters, meaning encounters and conversations that will widen and challenge people's way of thinking, right? I mean, that's the gift of college, is this opportunity to interact with people who you might not have interacted with before. The truth of for many of our white students at college, at Carthage, is that we have, I would say, between 20 to 25% students of color on campus. And for some of our white students coming from smaller communities, this might be the first time they are with this many people of color in their classes, in their residence halls, and all of that. And so it's really important that we provide opportunities for conversation and for learning and for understanding. So my role on campus is more around having interfaith conversations, right? So Rabbi Feingold has graciously been a guest many times on campus to share about Judaism. And she's even done this in the midst of a high holy holidays, graciously has come in and have those conversations. But we bring people in from all different denominations and all different faith backgrounds to have these conversations. Specifically around race and racism, My role tends to be holding vigils, sadly, after mass shooting events that tend to be rooted in racism and just rooted in hatred. And so my role on campus tends to be providing that space and place for reflection for our students and for our whole Carthage community.
For those of you just joining us, we're spending the first part of today's morning show with Pastor Kara Baylor, who is the campus pastor at Carthage College, and Rabbi Dina Feingold, who is chair of the organizing committee for a courageous conversation co-sponsored by Carthage and the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. And I don't think we've mentioned, but Rabbi Dina Feingold is with Beth Hillel Temple here in Kenosha. Rabbi Feingold, you were mentioning that we've already seen some of these courageous conversations around issues related to racism, but not one that focused specifically on racism as it sometimes plays out in faith communities. Can you tell us a little bit about what prompted you and others in the with the coalition to want to have a conversation specifically focused on this?
Yes, well, I have to give credit to this for this to Reverend Harvard Stevens, who has now left our community. But he was a member of the coalition at the time, and he and I had been having some conversations just on our own that I initiated because I had been invited to go to Montgomery and Selma with a group of 50 Reform rabbis. That's the denomination that Beth Hillel Temple is a part of, and I am part of the rabbis organization of the Reform movement. And we went to Selma and Montgomery in the summer of 2019 to really confront the issue of racism in the United States. And we were asked before we went to partner with a member of the Black, a pastor from the Black community in our respective communities to be together to help me ask the right questions and think about the right things before I went on this journey, and then to process it when I came back. And so I asked Reverend Stevens to do that with me, and he was also on the coalition. And so he came to me at one of our coalition meetings and said, you know, we should do one of these conversations on racism in religious communities. And I agreed with him, and we started to plan it, and it was going to be actually a year ago. And of course, the pandemic hit, and we just didn't know how to regroup so quickly and do something electronically like we're doing tonight. So that was the root of it. And then after Reverend Stevens left and, you know, we sort of regrouped, a different group came together to plan it for tonight.
I don't know that we've yet outlined the basic format of what is planned to occur tonight. And we want to remind people this courageous conversation is going to be taking place tonight in a virtual format, beginning at 6:30 this evening. Explain what the general format is going to be for tonight, and then we'll talk a little further about just what that might entail.
I'll take that. So we are going to have a moderator, Pastor Jim Lynch, who is a member of the coalition, ELCA pastor here in town. And we've invited seven different religious leaders from a variety of religious communities to address two questions. And so the moderator will start us out, and then each of these panelists will address the two questions, and they'll each be given 6 or 7 minutes to do that. And then there'll be another question that we have prepared from our planning committee to the whole panel. And then it will be opened up to the public And they will be able to put questions in on Facebook. This program will be on Zoom webinar format through Carthage, but it'll be streamed to, maybe Cara can answer this, to a site at Carthage, but also on the Coalition for Dismantling Racism Facebook page. So people will be able to put in questions to the panel, and then they'll be referred to the moderator, who will ask the panel to answer the questions. And the panelists represent a variety of Christian denominations, Unitarian, Baha'i, Jewish. I will be on the panel representing Judaism and Islam.
Very good.
And they'll be able to find the Zoom link on the events page for Carthage for today, March 25th. There's a lot of things that happen every day at Carthage. So since this is at 6:30 at night, I'll encourage people to keep scrolling. They will eventually find it for 6:30 tonight, and they could click on that link to be a part of the Zoom gathering, or I think it will be on our Equity and Inclusion Facebook page for Carthage, is where they'll be able to find the Facebook Live if they want to watch it that way. So since it's in a webinar format, the only people you'll see on the screen are the panelists. All the participants, you won't be able to see any of those people who are participating, but Rabbi Feingold said that you will be able to ask questions in the chat, and we'll have somebody moderating that and getting those questions to Jim when we get to the question and answer part, which is like the second half of the program.
One of my central questions here that I assume is going to also be approached this evening, and I'm really anxious to hear from both of you on this, is what is the nature of racism as it tends to play out in faith communities? Or are there particular things about faith communities in which it's really important to talk about racism in a particular way? Are there ways in which faith communities might find their racism maybe more deeply embedded, or maybe harder to detect, or more difficult to discuss, or is it just a matter of racism plays out everywhere in every arena of life and society, including our faith community? So let's talk about it there. I mean, I guess my question is there something in a sense special or distinct about racism as it plays out in faith communities? And for both of you as members of the clergy, I'm especially interested to hear your thoughts on that, on what you've seen, for instance, in your own faith communities and others with which you've worked.
I'll take the first stab at that question. I think churches reflect society, right? And I think part of what you had stated there, Greg, is true, that the churches reflect the world around them. But I think there's also something different in a faith community, in that our faith traditions call us not to live of the world, right? That we're called to something, to a vision of the world that is different, that is more inclusive, that sees all people created in the image of God, right? And so because of that, I think that there's a call on the church to do better and to be better. I think that in the Lutheran tradition, which is, I am an ELCA pastor, I have been for almost 21 years now, but you know, the Lutheran denomination historically in America has been divided ethnically, right? There were the Norwegian Lutherans or the Swedish Lutherans or the German Lutherans, and they all had their different churches, and it was divided by language. And so it wasn't that there were just, just white people going to the same church. I mean, it was white people of a very specific language and origin. So they were divided in that way. But then, you know, once more people took on English as their first language, those churches started to come together. But those ethnic identities always stayed very strong, right? You know they're Danish if they have an appelskiver breakfast, right? You know they're a Norwegian one if they're still like serving lutefisk, for heaven's sake. You know, some of those kind of things. And never broke down the walls, even though they talked about being colorblind, even though, you know, we would sing red and yellow, black and white, they're all precious in God's sight. Never did the work to create those welcoming communities. And in the history of the Lutheran Church, you know, one of the things that continues to stand out is how difficult it is for African American pastors to be called to congregations, right? So where in a graduating class where the white cohort will receive calls within, you know, the first 3 to 6 months after graduation, on average, Black pastors will wait a year to 18 months before receiving their first call. And a lot of that due to racism, our denomination is the whitest denomination in the United States. So most of our congregations are in communities under 10,000. So there's a lack of diversity just in the settings where you find ELCA churches. And there's not an openness to calling Black men or Black women as leaders of these congregations. So, and that's been true for hundreds of years.
Wow.
I don't think I could say it any better than Pastor Kara did, but I just want to emphasize that what she's talking about in the Lutheran Church is not unique. And I believe that this kind of situation that she's describing is probably true in every religious group in the United States and maybe beyond, but we're just talking about America here. Famously, Martin Luther King Jr. said on a talk show on TV in the 1960s that Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. And it's not, I mean, we don't have our services on Sunday morning, but it's true in all religious groups. And I think the reason we chose the title for tonight's program, Moving Beyond Denial, is that there's a lot of denial in different religious groups that this could be true of us. And just speaking for the Jewish community, you know, we think of ourselves as a people who have been subject to persecution and oppression, and you know, we have been, and murder throughout history for who we are. And we also think of ourselves not only as a religious or faith community, but also we're an ethnic group. So, you know, how could we have racism in our community? But the truth of the matter is that it's statistically speaking, about 15% of American Jews are people of color. And yet we don't see those kind of percentages in our congregations and in our other, you know, group type of institutions in the Jewish community. So why is that? So we need to look at that and look at the denial and see, well, maybe it's how we present ourselves and we aren't as hospitable as we think we are. And that we have to do, as Pastor Kara said, the hard work of looking at our systems, just like it is systemic, I think, in religion, just as much as it is in society. Racism is there, but until you really look at the systems that are in place that perpetuate it, you're not going to go forward.
Rabbi Feingold, I'm so glad you mentioned the specific title of tonight's Courageous Conversation, Moving Beyond Denial, because I really want to take a couple minutes to talk about specifically that denial and how one moves beyond it, and whether it's moving yourself or trying to move others beyond denial, it seems to me that denial is can be a very intractable force and not easily swayed. So what are your hopes for instance, tonight's event, but even beyond that? What are some of the ways in which people can be moved beyond their denial? I mean, is it just a matter of spelling out the facts that with which one cannot really argue, or is it about more than that?
Well, I think it starts with a conversation, and then if it just ends with the conversation, it doesn't, there's no progress. So there has to be some kind of action or follow-up. And just as an example, in our congregation, we've been really beginning to grapple with this subject, you know, a little bit last year, but I would say that especially since the George Floyd tragedy this summer. And we've formed a racial justice committee, and we've been trying to educate our community and provide book reads, and I've given a few sermons, and we have on our website a resource center where people can go for articles, videos, movies, things to read where they can educate themselves. And you know, so we're having various conversations within the congregation. And then beyond that, I think to get out there in the community, whether it's your workplace or a communal organization or things, you know, events that are happening in the community, and, you know, become actively involved in the change that we want to see. You can't just talk about it. You have to actually go out and work to make change.
Pastor Bailey, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, just a little bit, not because I think education is really key. Racism is so woven into the fabric of our society that, and we're so used to things being the way that they've been, that we tend to want to think this is just the way it is, right? It just so happens that, you know, all the Black folks live over there and the white neighborhoods over there, and that's just the way it is. And people need to educate themselves about the history of redlining and know that this has been purposeful and how it's how it was done and how these communities were created, and then how that impacts education, how that impacts transportation, how that impacts access to healthcare. So, I mean, people need to educate themselves and to know that decisions that were made, you know, 40, 50, 60, 100 years ago is really still impacting them today. And I think one of the biggest things that gets in the way of moving people beyond denial is, you know, the word racism, it really is a trigger word for people. And if you say that I'm a racist, you're saying that I'm a bad person and all of this kind of stuff, because, you know, the understanding of somebody who is racist is somebody who is willing to say they're a part of a hate group or things like that. When racism affects all of us, it's not being about being just good or bad, right? It's about you know, what kind of society do we really want to have? And what is the work that we really need to do to bring that society to bear? So, you know, I agree with Rabbi Feingold, you know, you've got to move to action, and you can't do everything. So I like to encourage people to think about what it is that they're passionate about, and work to dismantle racism in that area, because it really is everywhere. If you're passionate about education, you know, get involved in the school board or in your schools and look to understand, you know, what's in the curriculum? Are authors of color being read, you know, from kindergarten and 4K on, right? If you're passionate about transportation, get involved around transportation. If you're passionate about law, you know, so you get my point. I mean, you can't change things everywhere. So find the thing that you love the most and that you're most passionate about and work for change there, you know. So for myself, I am a Black Lutheran. I love my church, but I know that Lutheranism has a history of racism. And so where I'm trying to work for change is through my church and through my faith community. And so I think it's just really important that people continue to educate themselves, to move beyond this idea of you're either good or bad, and so you're either racist or you're not. We have to move beyond that dualistic way of thinking about this, and then, you know, finding that space and place where you feel like you have a calling, a passion to really make change around racism and continue to show up in those spaces.
As you're talking, Pastor Baylor, it reminds me that I think one of the tricky things about this, and especially when you talk about the word racism or racist as a real trigger word, is that for some people, they associate racism or being racist with white hoods and crosses burning on front lawns and the sort of the most overt and ugly kind of racism. And for them, that's what it means to be racist, or that's how racism plays out. And thankfully, while that kind of racism is by no means eliminated, we don't see that maybe the way we once did, but in its place, so often we see something that is maybe more subtle, which is not to say that it's any less serious. And because it's so subtle, it's also something that's maybe not as easy to understand, nor as easy to recognize in oneself or in others. So what do you hope will be accomplished tonight in this conversation to kind of broaden our understanding about what racism actually is?
Well, I hope that people will go through some kind of personal reckoning. If we open up the door to the idea, if religious leaders open up the door to the idea that we see that there's racism in our communities and that we ourselves understand that we are complicit in the structural racism in society, especially speaking for myself, someone who's white and walks in the world with white privilege, that very fact makes me complicit in the ongoing racism in our community. And if people see that religious leaders, whether they're Black or white, are talking openly about these things and suggesting a pathway to go forward, that maybe those who are watching will see themselves reflected in that conversation. If we can say, I can say, I have implicit bias. I know I have biases. I'm not a bad person. I'm trying to do good in the world. But I know I have bias and I have to do the work too. I hope that others will get that idea and respond appropriately. There's a quotation that I love from Jewish tradition that says that it's not up to us to complete the work, but neither are we free to desist from it. That we each have to do something to make the world better, to fix the problems that are right in front of us and that we may be part of. And that's a framework that I use for going forward and trying to do something to make change and to move beyond denial in this case. And I hope others will get that idea as well from our program this evening.
Rabbi Dina Feingold is chair of the organizing committee for tonight's Courageous Conversation, co-sponsored by the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism, co-sponsored with Carthage College. And Pastor Kara Baylor is the campus pastor there. Thank you so much, both of you, for being part of this conversation. We hope many people will seek out this evening's courageous conversation, Moving Beyond Denial, and the conversations to follow. Thanks again for being part of today's morning show.
Thank you.
It's always a special pleasure when a beautiful children's book crosses my desk. And even as someone who is not a parent, I often derive great joy from these books and can think of so many youngsters in my life who would enjoy them. And certainly that is the case with a wonderful book that has just been published called What the Road Said. It is the product of the great imagination of Cleo Wade, who has also written Heart Talk, Poetic Wisdom for a Better Life, and Where to Begin, a small book about your power to create big change in our crazy world. Time Magazine has lauded her work, and New York Magazine called her the Millennial Oprah. She is someone who cares deeply about the world and people, and works tirelessly to make this world a better place. And of course, the world is a better place when it has lovely, inspiring books like this for young people. And we're going to be talking with Cleo Wade about some of the work that she does and what was behind the writing of this absolutely beautiful book, intended for children, but which I very much enjoyed as well. Again, it's titled What the Road Said. Cleo Wade, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You have dedicated this book to your daughter, Memphis. And I suspect that when somebody writes a children's book and has a child themselves, that probably sort of changes the experience a little bit. I don't know for certain if you have written other children's books before this, but tell us about writing this with your own daughter in mind.
Yeah, you know, I this is my first kid's book. And when I started this book, I was not a mom or pregnant. And then about halfway through finishing it, I became pregnant. And then I wrote basically the very last pages of it as a new mom. And so it's been a really interesting and beautiful experience for me because, you know, this book really started as something I wrote to kind of heal the wounds of my own childhood and write a love letter to my own childhood self who so often felt lost or alone or lonely or kind of didn't know her place in a big world. And, you know, so it was really this kind of idea that I wanted to go back to that little girl and say, you know, here are some answers to all of your big questions that made you feel so lost. And then halfway through, I became pregnant and found out I was having a daughter. And so it's been such a, I honestly, this book has been an emotional roller coaster.
Hmm. Yes, you write in the author's note at the very end, this is a book for children. I really needed this book as a child. Maybe before we ask you how this book would have helped you as a child, give our listeners a sense of what this lovely book is about and what we mean by the road that is mentioned in the title.
So this book is about a traveler who meets this kind of magical road that appears out of nowhere. So she's kind of having a normal day, walking her normal way home, and everything feels the same. But this traveler is wondering, you know, I was wondered if there was something more, if there was something out there. And then one day this road appeared out of nowhere, almost as if it was magic. And she says to the road, where do you lead? And the road says, be a leader and find out. And she steps into this kind of really beautiful, whimsical land where she continues to ask the road questions. And so, you know, she starts out by saying, you know, well, you know, how do I start? And the road says, you have already started. And then she says, you know, well, what happens when I get there? And the road says, you know, you have just begun. Don't try to skip straight to the ending. Enjoy the beginning and the middle too. And, you know, that's kind of the rhythm of the book. And she has all these questions, you know, what happens if I get scared? What happens if I fall? What happens if I'm, you know, what happens if I need help? What happens if I'm lonely? And So, you know, there's, that's kind of the overall theme is all of these questions, and the road is really with her every step of the way, just gently encouraging her and comforting her, her big questions, and also encouraging her to kind of keep going on the journey. And so, you know, to me, when I think about my own childhood, I think, you know, gosh, you know, there were just so many times where, you know, I had that question where it was like, well, what if I go the wrong way? And, you know, in this book, the road says, you know, that is okay. Sometimes we go the wrong way on the way to the right way. And I think about all the kids who, you know, are afraid to, you know, get an A minus or a B or a C. And, you know, what if I do the wrong thing? Or what if this? And you know, children end up living with so much anxiety and worry, especially nowadays. And so, you know, I really just wanted to create this kind of soothing, calming experience for them that introduced a mindset that I thought would be really helpful, while at the same time reminding adults of, you know, this helpful way to look at life.
Absolutely. That's one of the things I wanted to say, is that I've found this book beautifully soothing and encouraging. And of course, it's not really designed with a reader like me in mind, but it's lovely all the same. I think a lot of people, when they glance at a children's book, assume that putting it together, particularly in terms of the words, that it's a simple matter, because obviously it's not the same thing as writing a novel or even a short story. I mean, in terms of the number of words, we're not talking about very many. And of course, we're also, generally speaking, talking about using language in relatively straightforward, simple way that children can read and comprehend it. But that doesn't mean that it's easy to write. Can you kind of take us inside the nuts and bolts of how you ultimately chose exactly the words that appear on these pages?
Yeah, you know, it's actually when you use very few words and try to make things as simple as possible that it becomes really difficult to write it, because you're constantly editing and trying to figure out, you know, how do I take this complicated idea and put it into text that, you know, for me, you know, it's interesting because I haven't talked to a single adult about it who wasn't like, I know I wanted to read it and keep it for myself for a couple of days before I shared it with my kids because I loved it so much, and or I felt like I really needed it, and I, you know, read it a few times. And, you know, when I was researching children's books for this book, you know, I think I read something like 250 kids' books when I was researching, and I realized that the kids' books that really impacted me were the ones that spoke to children but didn't leave out the experience the adult that might be also reading it was having. And so when you are trying to write a book like that, where it's not actually just like, you know, maybe like a really fun, silly language that like is really only kids speak, but you are actually trying to speak to more than one generation at a time, the language is so critical, and it's, you know, really tough. And so for me, I kind of started with themes I wanted to cover. For the first one, for example, might have been shame. You know, I really wanted to have a spread in this book that spoke to shame, and did so in a way that didn't say the word shame, because I think the word shame would be confusing for children, because I think it's confusing for adults. And so instead, I wanted to kind of introduce this mindset around, you know, okay, well, what's the way that we think that ends up, that, you know, makes us feel stuck in shame? And so much of it, at its most simple terms, is, you know, what if I go the wrong way? And, you know, because shame is, we make one mistake, we make one wrong turn, and we just get stuck there because we just beat up on ourselves and make ourselves feel so bad that we feel like we don't have another option and there's no redemption. And so, you know, I wanted to say, you know, well, what if I go the wrong way and the road gives this person a hug? And the hug really is supposed to represent compassion, right? Because as many of us may know, the way that we kind of get ourselves out of shame, if you are self-soothing, is through compassion. And so, and self-compassion. And so the road kind of curves a little, almost as if it's giving me a hug and says, that is okay. Sometimes we go the wrong way on the way to the right way. And so really that was kind of taking someone through actually how we leave a shame spiral but without using words like shame spiral or compassion or self-compassion, because those are all words you'd have to really explain to children in depth. But all this set of words, you know, I think a child could easily understand, and it also speaks to an adult.
Very much so. Yeah, it's a lovely journey that this youngster goes on, and even touching on issues like, what if people are mean to me? What if someone wants to fight? What if the world around us is filled with hate? And there is a gentle answer to every single question, to every single source of anxiety. I would certainly be amiss if I didn't mention that this book is breathtakingly beautiful to look at. Tell us about the illustrator of this book, who I understand has done her very first book with What the Road Said.
Yes, this is Lucy DeMoyencourt, my illustrator's first book, and it's my first book in the kids' space. But I looked through so many portfolios when I was trying to find my illustrator, but I really wanted this kind of old school feeling kids book, when kids books were kind of hand painted, and I wanted it to feel like someone had kind of watercolored this land and universe, because that always, when I was a kid, just made me feel so immersed in the story. And so I just couldn't find anyone that I thought, was what I was looking for. And then one day I remembered I followed this artist on Instagram named Lucy, and her Instagram was like, it's like Lucy in Wonderland. And she is a painter who would paint these beautiful, shells, and she's an artist in South Africa. And I sent her to my publisher and to my editor, and I was like, she is this woman, and she paints on shells, and she's so cool, and she, I just kind of think she could do this kid's book, although, what does it take to do a kid's book? I don't even know. And they were like, you know what, the worst she can do is say no, let's give it a shot. You've never done one, she's never done one, let's try to give her the benefit of the doubt. And we reached out, and she said yes, and then it was so crazy because it turns out that she was also pregnant, and we both ended up having daughters about a month apart or 2 weeks apart.
Wow. Well, it's absolutely amazing, and there is such a beautiful sync between your words and her pictures. They just flow together so beautifully, and whoever is responsible for the combining of words and music and responsible for combining the words with the pictures really deserves a medal for a really, really fine job. The book again is What the Road Said by Cleo Wade, and it is something that is sure to be a lovely gift for just about any youngster. Before I let you go, Cleo Wade, one of the things it says right at the top of your bio is that you are a community builder. Tell us why this is so important to you.
I just think that, it's like Audre Lorde said, without community, there is no liberation. And I think that community is ultimately what keeps people safe. And I think every day, our goal as human beings or people together in the same spaces or country or planet should be to keep each other safe. And I think that every single person deserves to be safe. And I think that we can only find that in community, because it's in community where we find solidarity. It's in community where we find connection. It's in community where we find belonging with each other and I think healing. And so for me, community is everything. It's always the goal.
Cleo Wade, thank you for giving the world this beautiful children's book, What the Road Said, and best wishes with all your future endeavors.
Thank you for reading it. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht and a conversation about the good work of the Gateway Foundation. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year.